There's some updates on the MacBooks that we discussed last week, the new MacBook Air and the even newer MacBook Pro. So Mayo, I will let you inform me on all the details, starting with the MacBook Air solid state drive speed. So it's cheaper. What's the catch?
Yeah, because obviously last week the MacBook Air was brand new. Apple obviously introduced it as just a 2019 update, implying that there were no specs changes apart from the addition of the True Tone display and bringing the price down to $10.99 for everyone and then $9.99 for students. What they didn't mention in the press release or anything is that the SSD component is actually slightly slower. It's about 35% slower on read speeds compared to the 2018 generation. So basically before this year's model, you could expect like 2 gigabytes per second read speeds and about 1 gigabyte per second write performance on the SSD if you run one of the benchmarking things like Blackmagic Speedtest, that kind of app. And it turns out people have got their hands on the 2019 MacBook Air, and it turns out that in fact you can only reach about 1.3 gigabytes per second read, and then the write speed is basically the same, maybe slightly faster, but essentially the same. So essentially you're getting a 35% reduction in the theoretically maximum read speed of the laptop. It's not nothing, but I think Apple probably made the right trade-off here if that's what they needed to do to get it $100 cheaper. We've talked about this before, right, about like, Apple's SSD pricing, and typically they've gone for, the highest spec components they can find, probably high quality components across the board. But that also comes at a cost, plus then you add on, Apple's insane margins and markup, and you get a really expensive part.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the 2019 Air, it certainly seems like they've been able to bring the price down, a decent amount by, $100 is nothing to shake your head at, and even $200 essentially for students, by using a slightly older storage device for the internals. And if you actually think about it, a 2 gigabyte read speed for a MacBook Air was probably overkill anyway. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a worse component, it's slower. There are going to be some operations that are slower. For instance, if you actually have like a 2 gigabyte or larger file and you want to copy it across onto another part of the drive, or actually do a file operation like that,
right?
Well, obviously it's now going to take longer because it's going to take more than 1 second, as it which was the maximum before. But the difference between 1 second and 2 seconds is not that great, on an everyday use anyway. And if you're looking at computationally intensive activities like opening an application, well, they're going to be smaller than gigabyte anyway, and even if they are slightly bigger, you're still at a speed that's going to be so fast that, your bottleneck is going to be primarily the CPU, GPU internals versus the actual solid state drive speed, right? Because there's a huge difference between going from the, 100 meg read speeds of a plattered hard drive to a 500 meg SSD to even a gigabyte SSD to it. And then as you go further up the scale, there's diminishing returns as you go from 1 gigabyte to 2 gigabytes, 3 gigabytes, right? A 35% slower SSD does not automatically make your computing 35% slower.
Right.
It'll only affect certain operations, and many things will be, easily pegged by something else. Like loading in a Final Cut Pro project, for instance, whether you'd be, there's an argument whether you would be doing that on a MacBook Air at all anyway. But even if you were, the processing on the video is going to be slowing you down, not how long it takes for the files to be loaded up and read off the disk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in talking about this, I hadn't considered this before, but I wonder how it, like, so 35% slower than from 2018 to 2019, that's the stat that we know, but I wonder how it compares to, like, what people might actually be upgrading from, because no one's going to go from 2018 to 2019 unless they just love True Display, I guess, because it's the same processor and the same hardware for the most part, except for True Tone. And so I wonder how it compares to like the last MacBook Air that they were selling, for example, which is probably an upgrade path that's more popular, than 2018, 2019 MacBook Air.
Yeah.
So surely it's faster.
It's faster.
Yeah, me too.
Going back that far.
Right, because that machine wasn't updated for several years, even though it was continued to be sold for, $1,000.
I've let you just Google it while you're talking, mm-hmm. and apparently the 13-inch MacBook Air would get 500 megs, between 200 and 500.
So you might, so what is that? Now you go from double. 500 to 1 gigabyte, yeah.
To 1.3.
Yeah, 1.3. So. Was it more than double, yeah. Well, that, that is
more than double.
So that's probably the real comparison that consumers would want to know, because you could probably count the number of people upgrading from 2018 to 2019 that are not like tech press on one hand, if even. So the real upgrade.
Yeah, because there's this whole thing where like everyone remembers that moment when all the laptops went solid state storage and everything got really fast.
Yeah.
But when that happened, they, you know, those weren't 2 gigabyte SSDs. Those were 500 meg SSDs.
Yeah.
We only started getting to like the 2 gigabyte, 2.5 gigabyte levels when the Apple T1 and T2 chips came around that, you know, put the SSD controllers on them even. Mm-hmm. Like before then, there was a period where it was like 500, then Apple upgraded into like a gig. And then starting, I think, with the 2016 MacBook Pro, that's when they actually started to get those like 2.2, 2.5 gigabyte speeds. Yeah. Because then they would run that on the T2 chip while also doing, you know, encryption on both sides as well.
Do they advertise the disk speeds, or is that something that you only see from like test results from reviews?
Yeah, you only see on the... iOS devices and RAM, they don't even say it on the page. They just say the capacity of storage for MacBooks.
Like if you're buying a standalone SSD, you care about that. And they used to give the speeds for the hard disk drive. So, you know, the spin speed, which is not a factor on SSDs. So I guess it's a different metric you also have like write speed on the hard disk drives too. But like they would say this is a 5200 RPM or 70, whatever the numbers were.
The base iMacs are still 5400 RPM hard disk drives.
Right, exactly, yeah. And you don't have that with SSD, which helps so much, but then the write speed is still, you can still have improvements of SSDs. So if you go from the last MacBook Air with the silver trim around the display to the new MacBook Air, either one you get, you're going to have a faster SSD. So I think that's the big thing here, is that they probably balance it out in a better way for consumers and users in a way that no one loses.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there'll be some small cases where stuff is slightly slower, but, you know, realistically, the number of people that are going to benefit from it being $100 cheaper to buy versus the people that will, you know, benefit from that 35% faster speed is vastly outnumbered and disproportionate.
Yeah, and if you value that, then maybe go to the Pro, which is also pretty light and thin, compared to like old MacBook Pros used to be.
I mean, Apple would never do this because then it starts making, you know, overly complicated SKUs. But they could theoretically offer on like the MacBook Pro, do you want the 4 terabyte that's $1,000 that's 2 gigabytes a second, or do you want the 4 terabyte that's only a gigabyte that's, you know, $500, right? Because obviously the slower parts are cheaper. They're never going to do this because, you know, as you get higher up the spectrum, people care about the dollar amounts less and less anyway because it's incremental value on a smaller and smaller percentage of the overall sum. But especially on the, you know, the MacBook Air is now their entry level computer, so going for cheaper parts there is probably fine. Mm-hmm. There would be more of a, you know, an outrage if like on the MacBook Pro they were like, you know what, we'll just make the SSDs worse, like which they aren't doing. So for the MacBook Air, the entry level, they have, you know, it is slightly worse, but they did compensate with the price going down. Again, I would be again angry if they had just bumped the MacBook Air and made it worse and not change the price, but because the price difference is there, you know, it makes up for it, right? And of course, everyone in a perfect world would love it that they wouldn't change it at all, when the base storage would be bigger than 128, because realistically now it should be like 256 gigabytes for every model across the line, but they don't do that. That's kind of the equivalent now of like the 16 gigabyte iPhone. Mm-hmm. We've kind of like eclipsed the minimum threshold for like unacceptable iPhone sizes now, because basically everything starts at 64. But on the Macs now, it's like, you know, 128 is probably too small. 256 should really be the base across the line, but they're not there yet.
Yep. And then last week we mentioned the new MacBook Pro entry level. So this used to be the MacBook Pro with no touch bar, and now it has a touch bar. It's got a different clock speed than it had before, I think. So, but there's a difference to all this. So what's happening there with the entry level MacBook Pro speed?
Yeah, I think on last week's show, we were a bit too quick off the button to like laugh at the 1.4 gigahertz high level number, which is the base clock of the new 12 MacBook Pro, because the 2017 model, which is obviously the previous generation, was 2.3 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just reading the numbers, it's like, wow, it got really worse. But for a start, the 2017 model was only dual core, and this is quad core.
Yeah.
And the 2019 versions actually turbo boost higher than the 2017 models do as well.
Nice. So under a load, you can get better speed.
Yeah, for a period, obviously, yeah. Before the heat. Because Turbo Boost is like, we can go really, really fast for a short amount of time, and then we have to cool down again.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, Turbo Boost comes into play quite often when you're doing things where you're like, oh, I really need to, like, do something intensive for, like, 10 seconds, and then again in 5 minutes' time. Obviously, if you were doing something intensive for 5 minutes continuously, you know, after 30 seconds, say, it would get so hot that it would go down to base clock. But obviously, in day-to-day usage, turbo boost speeds actually do matter, because a lot of people's usage of the computer is very bursty, not continuous. So that does play a factor. Plus, you also have the T2 chip now in the MacBook Pro 1299, which you didn't before,
mm-hmm.
which enables, for certain use cases, they have, like, the hardware encoders for, like, HEVC video, yeah. That kind of thing. So if you're doing video editing work and, you know, using those bit rates and those formats, those particular bit rates, you'll also see even bigger improvements. There was a nice video from Jonathan Morrison that did some, like, speed tests of the thing in MacBook Pro, and he saw that, like, in a Final Cut Pro 10 4K export, it was actually more than a minute faster than the previous model on doing the same task. So, you know, don't always laugh at the base clock speed. Talking to myself from last week. It is 100% faster than the 2017 model. And it actually gets surprisingly close to both single core and multi-core performance to even, like, the 1799 MacBook Pro, you know, the one with the 2.3 gigahertz base speed. Like, obviously that's still faster, but it's not a million miles away. If you actually look at when you go to 1799, you're also getting, like, more ports and stuff as well. So it's not, and you get bigger storage. So it's not a direct, oh, you're paying $500 more just for, you know, the extra CPU speed. But if you're sitting around looking at these things, you know, don't disregard the base model straight off the bat, like maybe we did last week. It is, yeah. It's a decent specification, yeah. At least for a MacBook.
Except for the base storage. I agree with you that the 128 is cutting it. And that was my favorite thing about the now dead MacBook, 12-inch MacBook, was that you could not buy 128. Maybe if they offered that, it could have been cheaper and more consumer friendly, but you couldn't buy less than 256. And with, I kind of get it with the Air, but, like, with the Pro, maybe they should. It really needs to be emphasized. Like, look, you might, if you're using this professionally, like, even as a student, you might run into some issues with that.
Yeah, I mean, I have a 256 gigabyte MacBook Pro, because that was the base model of the 2016, mm-hmm. and that's the one that I still have. And I would never buy a 256 gigabyte SSD again now. Like, it's too small. I've been hitting the limit for, like, the last 6 months, basically, like, you know, shuffling stuff around. So for me now, I'd be looking at, like, 512 minimum on this stuff. But which is, because it's funny, like, my iPhone is 256 gigabytes, and so is my laptop. But
yeah, it changes how you can use your Mac when you've got different amounts of storage, and there's a price tag associated with it, and you can't just give it all away for free. But it really does change how you use your Mac. So when you're buying, because, you know, you can't just swap out your drive later on for a larger amount, it's really something to consider. Sometimes more than, you know, I think RAM's also a big one. Like, 8 gigabytes is you probably, if it's, like, a long-term investment, you probably want to go to 16 if that's something that you can, you know, kind of splurge on as, like, a base level. And of course, if Apple did 256 with 16 gigabytes of RAM, like, every Mac would just cost more. But those are probably two things to really consider, like, maybe more than processor speed for a lot of things. Because the differences there are almost like you'll run into those in a way that you can't improve, I think. So
yeah, I mean, realistically, what is that 13-inch MacBook Pro going to sell to? It's going to sell to students, right? That's one of the reasons they wanted to get it out in time for back to school season,
mm-hmm. which was great.
Same with the MacBook Air, mm-hmm. and for, you know, browsing the web, word processing, presentations, reports, 8 gigs is probably going to do you fine. I mean, I went through university on 16 gigs, but I could have been fine on 8. Like, I was doing, obviously, if you're doing, like, you know, programming courses and compiling stuff, or video, you know, like, video editing courses, that's, you know, it's a different equation. But if you're just using, like, general productivity machine, I still think 8's okay. If you had to pick one thing to upgrade, I'd definitely go from 128 to 256 by a mile.
I can agree with that, yeah. All right, and the last thing on Macs for this week, at the front at least, is I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's been a while since I had a different MacBook notebook. So my desktop is still the iMac Pro, the base model refurbished, so it wasn't the full price. My MacBook has changed since last episode, and I didn't spend money on this. Like, I didn't go buy a new Mac. But our colleague, Chance Miller, was in town, and we had lunch and visited. And I think he was the first one to come up with the idea of we should trade our Macs. And then we talked about it more. And
did you just start this over lunch?
Yeah. We had Waffle House, so it was more like breakfast. But yeah. So he had a MacBook Pro from 2018. I had the MacBook Air from 2018. And so I think we were both just like curious about like using the other machine for a while. And they were similar enough that it wasn't like no one loses in this situation. But yeah, I went from a MacBook Air with 120 gigabytes of storage to a MacBook Pro with 256 gigabytes of storage. That's a win. And then I get twice the ports. And for me, I get the Touch Bar, which I said last week, like I was kind of curious about, you know, I hadn't used it one in a while. Yeah, and it's basically the same as 2016, which doesn't say much, you know, positive about the Touch Bar, but, it's the same story as always. The Touch Bar, like, you have to get used to the no escape key and the way that you control volume and brightness and not accidentally, activate Siri if you have that icon still there, if you don't remove it. But then there are things like today we moved our recording, schedule, I think up by 30 minutes. So I went to the calendar to change that, and it was just a really pleasant, design on the Touch Bar of like the calendar, timeline. And that's what I used to change it. So that was cool.
Yeah. Cause like the calendar app would like show you a range of the hours and you can just like drag it around.
Yeah. It was nicer than what was on screen. So that was neat. But yeah, so now I'm using the 2018. The only thing here is with the 2018 MacBook Pro is that has the third generation butterfly keyboard and it can't get the third generation take two. it can just have like another version of itself installed because there's a 2019 MacBook Pro that has the take two part of that. But the MacBook Air could get the take two part, right? Like, so then in the keyboard situation, I'd been putting off having doing the keyboard upgrade on the MacBook Air. Now I don't have to because I can't on the MacBook Pro. All in all, it was an upgrade for me, and Chance is happy too. So, he gets more battery life and a cooler laptop in terms of like heat on your lap. And then I've got less battery life. I'm doing the resolution, not the native one, but the like true 2X resolution.
Yeah. So you mean the native one, not the default one.
Yeah. Exactly. So the things
stupid
are
stupid wording, but yeah, that's how it works.
Things are larger, but I can see it better and it's sharper and, ideally, you know, better battery life just because it's not so much that the screen's got to drive. So I'm happy. Yeah. And I'm not going to make any claims about future Mac's decisions or anything like that. So this is what it is for the moment. So
yeah, I mean, I'd have said you're a bit stupid if you'd have bought this. When you first told me you'd bought a new laptop, I was like, oh, you've
bought I had a new laptop. Yeah.
Yeah. You told me you got a new laptop. I was like, oh, you must have bought one of these new, right? The new $12.99 one or something. And at this point, it's like, you know, if you have the, you know, income to spare and you're interested in higher tier models, right now is like the worst time to buy a MacBook Pro because the keyboard, you know, overhangs everything. Plus you have the rumors of the 16-inch redesign. So, you know, I'm definitely in the fence of like, you know, I'm probably going to move to the 16-inch when it comes out. So I've had this, you know, 2016 one now for a long time. So, you know, I'm coming around up to it, but just trading an Air for a Pro is, you know, perfectly fine. And I would say you got the better end of the stick.
Yeah. And you know, we mentioned last week with the 12-inch MacBook going away, I'd written this story about Apple getting rid of their most kind of futuristic Mac with no upgrade path forward because you just can't get another Mac with no fan and, you know, the same portability. It's similar portability, but not exactly the same. That story is really popular. Like I looked back at the last, I think like 7 days of stories in that range. And it was like the top story, which for that, I honestly, when I was writing it, I thought this is just for myself. Some people will read it and agree. Most, like 98% of people will read it and hate it. And, you know, you can't take like the audience, reading it with like agreeing with it or not. But it at least was like the top, like the top story of all the news that happened in the last 7 days around that period. It was like the top story of that. So I was really surprised by that. So I think a lot of people, I'm going to go ahead and say agree with it that the MacBook form factor was awesome and needs to return.
I'm sure that form factor will come back in the future when they have, you know, ARM or a different approach, but it's going to be a couple of years.
Yeah, I'll accept that.
It's easy to think that cybercrime is something mysterious that happens to other people. It's easy to feel like no one wants your data, but you'd be mistaken. Your privacy is always under attack. When the internet connection is unencrypted, your data is being transferred over the air in the open. You can't see it with your eyes, but unencrypted network traffic can be easily read by unscrupulous actors as if it was just written on a poster on the wall. Take back your privacy with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address so no one can see what you're doing. To enable ExpressVPN, it just takes one click. ExpressVPN uses cutting-edge technology called Trusted Server to make sure that no one can keep logs of what you're doing online. It has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. You can get up and running for less than $7 a month, and your purchase comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. One subscription applies to every device you own, from Macs to iPhones to iPads, even Android phones, home routers, and other devices too. Use ExpressVPN to surf public Wi-Fi without fear of being snooped on and keep your personal data private. ExpressVPN creates an internet without borders, defeating content restrictions for online media, music, services, and more by masking your real IP address wherever you are in the world. ExpressVPN has 24/7 human support to help you get up and running. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/happyhour. That's ExpressVPN.com/happyhour for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/happyhour to learn more.
All right, let's talk about some Apple TV Plus stuff. So Apple TV Plus is it's like Apple's version of sort of Netflix. Like if Netflix was only the original content, this was the TV service announced back in March to be released sometime this fall for an unknown price, probably $10. We don't know. But what's going on in the Apple TV Plus space this week that is not the price that we don't know yet?
Yeah, we've been talking about this for a little bit. Like, surely Apple is not going to be, you know, radio silent on TV Plus for the entire summer and only bring it up again in, you know, September, October when it's ready to go. And now they finally have some, you know, motion of promotion of stuff that's coming.
Yeah.
We saw, kind of timed with the Apollo 11 anniversary, we saw a kind of behind the scenes discussion chats, half featurette type of thing for the For All Mankind show, which obviously Apple showed the trailer for at WWDC. Plus, they have this like partnership with Snoopy and the Peanuts like team, the Snoopy cartoon. And so they previewed a show called Snoopy in Space, again, you know, drawing on the space anniversary idea. The one thing that interested me specifically was that the For All Mankind show, the producers and the directors did like a load of interviews with all these different websites about it. And in one of the bits, it said that For All Mankind will be a 10 episode first series, and each episode will be an hour long. And that's kind of like the first glimpse we really have of like the Apple TV Plus format.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I mean? Like, because who knows? All they said today is that they've formally announced about a dozen shows, mm-hmm. and we've obviously heard about, you know, probably like three dozen total in, you know, murmurs and rumors and different reporting. The sizzle reel trailer that they showed, you know, back in March, that had glimpses of like 12, and they said they'd be adding new shows every month.
And they had a big word cloud of the talent involved so far, mm-hmm. too. Yeah.
Yes. And I think most of that word cloud was accounted for by the sizzle reel stuff, but not all, because there were definitely like some comedians and some films, because obviously they only showed TV shows, but Apple TV Plus will also include, you know, original films that they've licensed or, you know, bought to produce,
mm-hmm.
Which will be cut as part of those, you know, monthly editions. So if you look at For All Mankind, and they don't say if it's going to be released all at once or weekly, you know, like whether they're going to do the kind of binge format where it drops all at the same time. I'm assuming Apple is going to go for weekly episodes, because I feel like the binge format where they just drop everything at once is kind of a waste of good content. It's like, oh, here's everything at once. Great. It'll be interesting to do for a day and then you'll be done with it. Versus, you know, we can have excitement anticipation for if there's 10 episodes, what's that? That's
2.5 months.
10 weeks. So 2 months and a half, basically. Yeah. So you could do one, you know, one episode every week for almost 3 months. get the build up, get the chatter, especially with like dramas, which it seems like Apple TV Plus is going to a lot have. I feel like having the time gap is a nice way to build like tension, suspense as well. Like being immediately to pop over to the next episode is like, well, great. Plus, you still get most of the benefits of the binge format in the long run, because obviously post, say if they start in January, post March, when all the episodes are run out, any new customers can obviously go and, you know, watch that stuff in a binge style if they want to. It's not like they're going to take stuff down. That's one of the benefits Apple has, is being, you know, is owning the content. They don't have to worry about like licensing periods. Oh, you can only watch this for a year and then they'll get rid of it. They can obviously just keep it on the permanent archive.
Yeah. I wonder, I'm sure Netflix maybe has some data on this, but I wonder like if how it affects the show's performance. If it's binge on launch weekend and you get more viewers than if you do it over a span of time and it slowly drops off. I wonder how those numbers compare, because I agree with you that it's like more, it's better as storytelling if you can have a point where you're like, what happens next? And then you have to wait a week to find out. And when it's like, you have that big ending and then the next scene starts in the next episode immediately after, then it, oftentimes it isn't even like, this is what happens next. It's like you're building a whole new, you know, scene for it. But personally, I like to be able to binge something like over a weekend if possible, because it's like even committing to a show every week is tough these days. So I don't know. But I do wonder like if Netflix probably has the data, if Apple has a clue about, you know, what would increase viewers. They probably also want to know what increases subscribers and like makes them the most amount of money. With this, as to which format they do all at once or over the span of a few weeks. And even though you do at the end, after 3 months for each show, it's like rolling. So at some point, you know, there are shows that have the same release schedule. Hopefully if they do continue to release new stuff, like they say they will, then, you know, you'd have that to go for it. But, I know Hulu did some stuff like that too. Like they've had some shows where there's one a week and then after that it's all out there, of course. And you can see all the ones that have come up before that. But I think they've also taken the other approach and say, we're going to put it all out there at once. So, and I think that's been the more modern thing to do even for Hulu. So we'll see.
One of the reasons I think Apple's going to have to do bi-weekly to start or per week is they just don't have enough of a library to sustain dropping everything.
Yeah. But in that same way, like if you just have a limited library, 10 episodes of 5 shows is more content than 5 shows with one episode each, you know,
let's say they launch with 12, right? Just as a, so then you get, the service comes out, you get 12 things to watch, and then you're told, you know, next week there'll be another episode to watch, versus, oh, you can watch everything in 1 week, then you can cancel your subscription before it even renews. Like they can at least stretch, if you get someone hooked on, say, For All Mankind, they can at least get season one on three renewals of the subscription versus you watching it in one go, you're paying $10 and you're being done.
If you had to guess which one they do, what would you guess?
I think they'll do weekly.
Okay, and I think they'll do all at once. So we've got that going for us.
Maybe they'll do both, and some things will be weekly and other things won't be. Especially, you know, like the homes, like documentary series where they go around like rich people's homes and show it off. That's something where I could see them maybe doing all at once. Where I think for me, the impacts of the dramas really benefit from having those time delays and building press and building anticipation before, versus, you know, everyone just like watching in one day.
Yeah. I think the way the press often goes is like the TV reviewers will get access to like the first 2 to 3 episodes, not even the whole season. And then they've got to review the whole series. Like, is it worth your time to start watching this based on that? Even if the shows are going to be all released at one time. So I still think that like they'll just do the obvious thing to me, which is to put it all out there at once. And it'd be weird to have some shows are all at once. Some shows are released, as, you know, weekly. We'll see. Rewinding a little bit back to so some of the stuff that's come out this week. So the For All Mankind, like that show that they've shown a lot of, including the full trailer for it. That one is, the premise of that is, what if America wasn't the first country to put a man on the moon and Russia had won the space race? But because America lost the space race for that, they looked at it as like, well, we have to do something much bigger so we continue and make more advances. Whereas like the space race was like, we won and, you know, okay. All right.
Yeah. It's like as if the space race didn't end.
Yeah.
People just kept going.
Right. And so the timing, especially so what the anniversary there is this month, I think June the 20th or July the 20th is like the landing of the first, you know, man on the moon. So that's clever that they can like promote it in this way with the 50th anniversary of that. So that's a big deal. Like not the first time we were in space, but, or like launched a rocket, but when the first time like that we took steps on the moon. And then the Charlie Brown thing, well, not Charlie Brown, but Snoopy in space. Similarly, like that was a thing that was going to exist, but because of this anniversary this week, they can look at that and, tie it all in together. It does create this effect though of like, so far they're showing all this space stuff and that's it. Yeah. But I do think it's like just because they've got like 49 years of, wasn't like the big anniversary, 50 years, and they won't have this opportunity again. And it's like a multi-day experience because like it was like, I think like a 4-day process to go from launch to walking on the moon. So, it's tidy, I think, because of how they're doing that. But, it still feels like their big show that they really love is going to, like, with, well, I don't know. Maybe our next conversation will change that, but I feel like the morning show is like their flagship show, like, from how they presented it so far, because of the talent involved, Steve Carell, Reese Witherspoon, and Jennifer Aniston. And that'll be like what they think they show that the most in promotions, and like they'll get more customers from that show.
Yeah, that is definitely one of their, like if you look on the Apple TV, like page, not the Apple TV Plus page of the website, just the Apple TV page, they have a section which advertises Apple TV Plus, obviously, and that has a background image of not of three of the shows from, you know, the 12 that they showed in that, you know, minute and a half reel, and those three shows are For All Mankind, The Morning Show, and C. So they're the ones that they're really like pushing in terms of, you know, the imagery. Maybe that's just because they have them, they think they're impressive in a, like a static image, and they have them done.
But, and it's kind of balanced in terms of like what it is. So,
yes. Yeah. Because there was a report this week that C is reportedly costing Apple $15 million an episode, which is obviously a lot. And some people have said it might even be like the most expensive TV show ever made, just based on per episode costs. I would expect personally that the price they're paying for The Morning Show is not too far off that number either.
Right.
Wasn't it like last year they said that Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston were getting $1 million an episode?
Yeah, I think so.
So that's one. So there's 2 million out of 15 already. Assumedly, Steve Carell will be getting close to that as well. So you're already getting up there. The reason C might be more is because obviously there's going to be more CGI and like visual effects in that. Mm-hmm. So the budget for that will be higher.
Yeah, and that's the show starring Jason Momoa, who is Aquaman in the movies and is from Game of Thrones. Is that right?
I know him from Game of Thrones. I'm sure he did other stuff before that.
But. Yeah. Well, I just mean like I don't know Game of Thrones. So
yeah.
So he's in Game of Thrones. Okay. Yeah. And that's the show that the premise is, imagine you're in a world where the idea of vision is like possibly a myth that you're told, and like you're not sure that it's ever existed before, and you that it's normal, and that like that's the world building, is that there's no vision. And then what's the twist to it, like that someone is that's it, or is it that someone has vision, or it's been
well
we're so far out now, yeah,
it's just what would it be like if the human race can't see?
Yeah.
So Which is a bit contradictory to the, you know, how visual effects masterpiece that it's supposedly going to be. Yeah. So it's definitely be interesting how that one's framed, because you know, a baseline is be very easy to make a show about not being able to see boring. Like, yeah. Like, you know, that's not against like disability or anything. That's just, you know, if you have like, how do you get characters to interact in the world if they can't like see each other and see what they're doing? Like,
oh, we'll see for $50 million an episode. and also, before WWDC, which included the trailer for All Mankind in full, and had a full recap of the March event in the opening. So we know that Apple will use future events, you know, likely to promote what was announced in March, but in more detail. We can probably expect Apple TV Plus to be a big part of like the iPhone event if it's ready to launch, right? Like you'll get the iPhone 11, all that stuff. You'll get the Apple Watch Series 5 if that's a thing. And then you'll get like Apple TV Plus, and like it'll be like a big reminder for people, just like they did like two Apple Watch events, you know, for unveiling it, and then for like actually going through the price and everything. It's maybe like half.
We don't know price yet,
right? Yeah, maybe half of it is like it will feel like half hardware event, and then half of the March event again.
And maybe it was arcade as well.
Yeah. So, All right. Yeah. What is the, so in the notes, Apple TV branding issue with Twitter? What's that?
Oh, yeah. This is funny. So on the Snoopy announcement, there was the account Peanuts had showed the trailer, obviously. They're we're promoting it. And so their tweet was, Snoopy in Space is coming this fall to Apple TV Plus only on at Apple TV, because the Apple TV account is at Apple TV.
Yeah.
And so I slid onto that to look at the details, and 10 of the replies were people saying, but I don't have Apple TV, I can't watch it. And then I then slid on the details of those, and at least half of those people were tweeting from an iPhone.
So the
branding
be
issue, yeah. You know, Apple TV, Apple TV set. People think it's a real TV.
Yeah.
People don't know that the TV app is not the Apple TV thing. It's not the same thing people are talking about. I was interested just to see what the common mind was thinking about this stuff. So I actually replied to someone saying, you're tweeting from an iPhone, right? You can use a TV app. And then this person replied and she was like, you know, I've never even opened that app. I didn't even know that's what it was. So I definitely think there's going to be some branded difficulties of explaining to people it's Apple TV Plus. But to use Apple TV Plus, you need Apple TV. But no, not the box. No, not on actual TV. Not necessarily. You can do it on your phone or your iPad.
Well, my takeaway from that is, what a cool way to use Twitter and find the non-technical people. You know, since Twitter has gone mainstream, then we can do that. That's clever. New emojis. This is a quickie comment. What is so? What I know about new emojis are, we've seen previews earlier this year of new emojis that would likely be coming, that were proposed, and then Apple did, as part of World Emoji Day, these are new emojis coming at some point in iOS 13, which probably means 13.1 around October or so. What's your comment on new emojis?
So yeah, there's 59 emojis. Whatever. What was interesting to me, obviously, is they're now doing these. They're doing the disabled emojis, and they're doing a more diverse emoji options for the, so for instance, the emoji where you have two people standing next to each other,
mm-hmm.
You can choose, in addition to gender, you'll be able to choose any combination of skin tone for every person,
mm-hmm.
to personalize the people holding hands emoji. Well, my immediate reaction to that is, you know, great, great, diversity is fine, whatever. But how are they going to expose that in the UI? Because the current picker, when you press on an emoji and then you choose your skin tone, there's only space for five options. And with this hand holding thing, there's going to be 60 combinations between gender and the five different skin tones. So does this kind of, you know, tip the hat on an update to the emoji keyboard coming not in iOS 13? Obviously this will probably come in iOS 13.1, potentially including other stuff that people wanted, a search field. Because it just seems to me that the current UI you have for picking emoji on the keyboard is not going to scale to having an emoji that can be customized in 70 different ways.
Yeah, and right now it's more like you hold down on an emoji and then you leave your finger down and you can drag around to pick a default color that you want instead of yellow. And there are five color options aside from yellow, so six total. But ideally, if you're picking these, you've got all those combinations, then you would want to maybe take your finger off the screen and really do some customization to those. So yeah, that's interesting. We'll see if they ship just what they have now scaled up to all those options, and you have to just really thumb around it, or if they do something designed for that sort of thing. So we'll see. And Android will have the same challenge, right? Because this is the new emoji set, and so to adopt it, then you need to adopt all those things. And so maybe Android and Windows and iOS and the Mac will have their own approach to that. That's something technical that we'll have to watch out and see for. Interesting.
Hiring these days just isn't as simple as putting an ad in the newspaper or posting to a job board. With more qualified candidates than ever before and remote work expanding the hiring pool further, you need something to help you find the right people for your business. When you're juggling the need for new hires with everything else it takes to grow your business, it's important to be able to reach out to the right candidates at the right time. This is where LinkedIn Jobs comes in. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. Over 600 million members visit LinkedIn to make connections, learn and grow as professionals, and discover new job opportunities. In fact, LinkedIn members add 15 new skills to their profiles and apply to 35 job postings every 2 seconds across the platform. LinkedIn's wide database enables them to put your job post in front of the people with the right academic qualifications and soft skills to meet your role requirements. Education and grades are important, but LinkedIn also considers qualities like collaboration, work ethic, and adaptability. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. To get $50 off your first job posting, go to linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get started now with a $50 discount when you make your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, Mayo, as we get closer to September, it's July now, so we've got like a full month and a half until we have an iPhone event. What's going on with the iPhone 11 at this point in state in time?
Yeah, remember the stuff we kind of talked about all the way back in January with the square renders of like the triple camera in the camera bump in like this almost Apple Watch style rounded rectangle that's really big and was very divisive at the time, and there were plenty of people on Twitter telling us this is no way going to be correct. Well, you know, zoom forward to July, and pretty clearly that is correct.
Yeah.
Circling like around YouTubers this week, including our own 95 Mac, Jeff Benjamin, did a hands-on with one. These iPhone 11 like dummy units have circulated around. So in addition to all the renders and the schematics leaks, there's now been like decent and like thorough hands-on with dummy units looking at, you know, the January design essentially. One point to note on these dummies is they're slightly inaccurate in that they kind of look like a iPhone XS camera bump just made twice as wide, in that it's like sitting on top and it's like a black glass plus the extra cameras. And if you actually get one of these dummy units, the cameras don't actually work or anything. So they're just, you know, they're just fake. Even there's even an iPhone 11 clone that runs Android, and in that case, they again replicate that triple camera setup, but only one of the cameras works. The other two are just like blank holes. What you have to imagine if you want a truly accurate depiction of the iPhone 11 design is to take that layout with the triple camera in that like triangular configuration in the rectangle, but the glass of the not of the camera bump is not black. It's the same glass as the back of the phone. So if you have a gold one, it'll be gold. If you have a black one, it'll be black. If you have silver, it'll be silver. Because the camera like protrusion is not a separate part. It's just like one sheet of glass covers the back and the camera. So the construction is almost like unibody, like it's just one piece. Mm-hmm. So it's almost just like a raised section in the same piece of glass. It kind of reminds me of the iPhone 7 camera design, which was obviously an aluminium back, but that also did the thing where it kind of like beveled in the camera, right? It wasn't just like a sandwich of something.
It was like it was one material and not something stuck onto it, right?
Yeah, it like kind of curved up to support the camera, you know, a lens. Mm-hmm. And that's more what this will be. It'll be like a single piece of glass that rounds up to then have the three cameras in that triangular arrangement with the flash and stuff on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at that design thinking, oh, it's ugly because there's a big black rectangle, rest assured, you can instead think it's ugly because there's three triangular dots instead. Like, I'm not saying it necessarily makes it look good anymore, but it is just to keep in your mind, it's better to remember it in that way.
Yeah, and so the thing about the dummy units are, we see these every year now, it seems like, and the point of them is to like, so these are the dimensions, like especially when there's new screen sizes, they're especially informative. And in this case, like the thing to see is like the camera area is going to be way different. And it seems to be made like these kind of leak out because case makers need the dimensions so that they can design accessories ready for launch. You know, based on the cutout of your camera hole needs to be this giant thing now. The buttons for volume and lock and muting are going to be over here. Like, even if they're like slightly tweaked, you need to know that. And so these things, like those specs are out there for case makers and they're not tightly held, I suppose. And so people 3D print and, you know, like you said, with the Android phone, like go to great lengths to replicate what will the next iPhone look like. It is informative and like, oh, this gives you an idea of what to expect. And they're never so accurate that it's like you'd pass it off as the real thing because there's always like some design tweak, like the shade of the color, or, I mean, and oftentimes like they're like they're plastic or whatever material. They're not like the same materials even.
Yeah, they're lower grade, so even stuff like the rounded edges aren't perfect. Yeah, and stuff. Like it's close, but it's not perfect.
And the one big thing to consider here when look at the dummies and like what you'll see ship is that the back glass is expected to be frosted glass, like on some of the Google Pixel phones. And that'll just make it look different too, because we don't know what that will look like for Apple and how it will affect the color. And especially like the gold dummies never seem to be as attractive as like actual phones just because of the materials and everything. The best looking phone will probably be the space gray one. If you're offended by the look of the camera holes and the way that the colors all either clash or go together, because it'll look more like one seamless thing just with different raisings up. But then all the colored ones just like now, I mean, the colored ones don't blend as well if it's white or gold, and that'll be even more true with these. Do you think one thing I look at these dummies and think about is like, with that big of a camera bump, maybe the Apple logo should kind of go down a little bit?
Do you think, I agree with you, actually.
Yeah. Do you think that they will, or that the dummies are going to be so accurate that this it's up there where it is and looks funny?
My understanding is that the dummies are made off of CAD schematics leaks. And I don't know this for 100%, but I believe that because the Apple logo doesn't have any structural relevancy, the CAD leak will not show where the Apple logo is.
Yeah, the only thing I could think about is like that would make it correct in the dummies is if for some reason case makers needed to know where the Apple logo is to do that dumb cutout.
A lot of case makers do that to show you the hole.
Yeah, but maybe the early...
Because everyone has this idea like, oh, we want this case, but we don't want to lose the Apple logo. It's like, right. So they all put these massive like portholes in it just to show the Apple logo. It's like, I hate those cases.
Yeah. It's kind of cheesy, but... So that's the only thing I think is like maybe what might be right, but I would just like I would probably guess, you know, you've got to really read into like why these things are out there to have that idea. But I would guess that when we see this actually, like the Apple logo will maybe bump down a little bit because the camera bump just gets too close to it. And there's just too much going on, and it would
I agree. There should be more padding between the camera bump and the logo. The iPhone tech's probably in the right place. It's just the Apple logo needs to move down a bit, which is kind of like how they do on the iPhone like XS battery cases, obviously, because it has that massive ridge at the top. The Apple logo naturally goes further down the case. So if they did that kind of positioning, it would work out quite well. Obviously, in January, we weren't like over-enthused about the triangular design. Now it's July. Have you mellowed? Do you think it's better? Are you looking forward to the design? Are you still like, ooh, what do you think?
Well, and back then there were also like competing designs. So there was a week where we were like, oh my, you know, what is this that we're looking at? And then the next week they were like, oh, that could have been like a rough early start. Now they've got this, you know, refined design. Hopefully it's this. And then, you know, it was like, oh, that's too good to be true. this is what we have to deal with. I'm more concerned about it with so for 1 year, I think it's fine. Like, you know, you make, advances at the cost, you know, you get performance benefits at the cost of like how it looks. I mean, even like going from the 10 to the 10S, just something as subtle as like the lines around the band, they're worse from the 10S than they are in the 10. There's more of them. You know, they're not symmetrical,
asymmetric drills on like you grow
with the holes, right? Exactly. So you make those changes, but like hopefully in the future you find ways to improve that and you get back to like more symmetry. And so I think the same thing with this camera stuff. Like hopefully, you know, it's not for like the next 10 years of iPhones. They all look like that if you want to have good cameras. And it's especially, interesting on like the 10R replacement phone, because then you'd get two cameras from what we believe, but you still get the big bump. Anyway, maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe it's just to, you know, for the look of it all.
Oh, by the way, one thing on the 10R, the new 10R, apparently the second camera that they're adding is not the zoom, is not the 2x zoom. They're adding ultra wide.
So you'll get
the normal camera you have now plus ultra wide, where, so it'll be not like, you know, like the iPhone 10, which was obviously, you know, 2x zoom and normal and telephoto and wide angle. You'll be getting the wide angle plus ultra wide.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly coming around to like this being the design, and I can't My acceptance is more on like just knowing the way that these rumors go and ones that we can believe in and ones that we don't believe in. And this just feels like we're just seeing a preview, like a rough draft of what's to come. Where I'm more curious is, does this stick around for 5 to 10 years? Like, or do we advance? Like, we've not gone from no camera bump to the camera bump back to no camera bump. We've gone to a camera bump that looks tiny these days compared to like where we started with the iPhone 6. And even like,
the progression is the camera bump is getting ever bigger.
Yeah. So, surely you, with advances, you could reduce this bump to not be that bad in like maybe 5 years. I don't know, but. That's what I'm more curious about is like, is this the new normal or is this like just an off cycle? And then you get, more like that optimistic design we saw where it was like across the top instead of like a square. It was like, you know, a sideways pill. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause obviously this is a year where they're mostly sticking to the same design as the iPhone X and the XS. Next year, I think the kind of current consensus, although we don't know what it's going to look like, the 2020 iPhone, we generally believe is not going to look like a, you know, an S revision of the iPhone X. I think next year they are going to go in a more drastic direction. We don't know what that'll look like yet, but obviously that means there's more opportunity for them to like think about the camera integration. The way I kind of like see this year's design, I don't think it's going to be the prettiest iPhone ever. I think it will look better than people expect. I don't want to like excuse it. I still don't think it's going to look great, right? But it's going to look better than I think what people currently have in their head when you're in the flesh, especially on like the space gray phone, which is my color anyway. So, you know, if I do upgrade this year, it'll probably look great. Or actually, in space gray, it's the silver and gold colors where it's going to look particularly bad.
Yeah. Well, and cases will look funny when they've got like 85% of the back of the phone covered, but then you do like have this big crack area that the case cannot cover because it's the camera.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be like the current phones, right? Which obviously, like...
But even
there's
more.
There's just a weird thing now where they've gone from a threshold of, like, a skinny bump to a big bump. And there's some like, point between those two where it just becomes too much and overbearing. And it definitely seems like that's, you know, where we're headed this year. But the way I see it is that Apple was getting railed for the camera quality dropping, not relative to itself, but relative to the market, mm-hmm. right? The iPhone camera was, for a long time, you know, through like the iPhone 5 era, was heralded as the best smartphone camera you could buy.
I mean, it really started with the 4, I think.
Yeah, like the 4 was like when they upgraded it a lot, and people were like, wow, the iPhone 4 camera was great. And then they had the 5, and then that's when they started doing the Shot on iPhone campaign and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a big deal. It was like, the iPhone is the most popular camera in the world. That was literally one of the iPhone 5 ads. And then, you know, more recently, I'd say from about the start, from around the time the original Google Pixel came out, which was probably 3 years ago now, mm-hmm. Which is a perfect time for them to start designing a new camera system, by the way, if you think about Apple's 2 to 3 year lifespans. They started hitting a time when the iPhone was arguably not the best camera on any phone that you could buy. It is still a very good camera, right? And I think people, again, kind of hype up the Pixel too much in some instances, where it's like, you know, the iPhone camera's better at something and worse than other things.
Yeah, we've gone on that before, deeply.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, obviously. But clearly, it is by no means now that the outright winner, right? There are clearly cases where other phones, especially with, like, low-light photography, like, a lot of Android phones do a lot better than the iPhone does. The iPhone goes really, like, mosaic-y and, like, blurry. So, I see this design as, like, right, what do we need to do to make the best camera on a phone again? Or at least the best equal to what's on the phone, right? And through a combination of software and hardware, I think that's what the iPhone 11 camera system will be. And if they deliver on that, people are going to excuse the design after, you know, a couple of weeks. They'll get on with it. You know, it was not going to be the greatest thing in the world. It's not going to be the prettiest iPhone they ever made. But if it can deliver on the camera quality, in terms of definition, in terms of zoom, then, you know, people are going to be happy with it ultimately at the end of the day. And it'll be kind of like the iPhone 4 antenna lines where, you know, Jobs even like pointed to, and it was like, these antenna lines exist because it's used as the structural integrity of the antenna system. And then it'll be like, here, look how we've engineered this incredible camera system into such a thin profile with a perfect unibody piece of glass, and it produces the best photos that you've ever seen, far, far eclipsing what you see on the XS. And when they do that and they give that narrative around it, it will be like, you know, the kind of criticism and like hatred will like dissipate. So
that's my
stance.
Do you think it looks better or worse than the Samsung Galaxy S10, which has three cameras, including an ultra wide lens, and looks more like if the iPhone 7 Plus added a third lens? Because the iPhone 7 Plus was the sideways pill. It was like landscape orientation. Do you think the Galaxy S10 looks better than the iPhone 11 dummies, or you know, what do you think there?
It's hard to say. Like, I think they both have different qualities of ugliness. Hmm. The thing that always gets me about this square design is why are the holes not like in a square, which is what the Huawei phone does, where it's just like it has the three lenses in each corner of the square, and then the fourth corner is the flash. So you have a very like equidistant spacing of all three cameras. Whereas clearly Apple has gone, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a rectangle and then put a triangle inside it. That's what gets me, you know, upset and agitated. The Samsung design is definitely better in that regard, because it's still like a very uniform, like three in a row type of situation.
Yeah.
But again, if the iPhone can deliver these great photos at the end of the day, That'll be what it was known for, and the weird triangle become like a signature look. So similar to AirPods, right? AirPods look a bit stupid, but people vibe with them because they're so good. So again, it's not going to be the most prettiest visually thing ever to grace Apple's industrial design team.
Maybe more similar to the iPhone notch on the front. Like you know, we all had our opinions at the beginning, and now it's popped up in a lot more places than the iPhone, and that where you can do a generic modern smartphone design and you include some kind of a notch, or you don't get the same features. But
yeah, if the 11 comes out and it has this design and the pictures are still considered inferior in many aspects, then you've got a problem.
If it's like the same main camera and 2x camera, but you also get ultra wide,
that'd be rough.
Indeed. All right, I think some things we'll have to say for next week to discuss, but I want to go over a few things here before we jump off. One thing is that we're fully on Apple Card watch, because that's Apple's credit card coming to the U.S. with Goldman Sachs partnered as the bank behind it, their first consumer card. Let's see. So Apple Retail has been testing it for a long time. Employees at corporate have been testing it for even longer. And like, people on Twitter are not shy about telling us, like, yeah, we've been using it on iOS 12.4 and iOS 13 betas. But it's not out yet. And we thought maybe this would be the week. Doesn't look like it. What do you think? We think we're going to see this in July or August?
Yeah, I bet it comes out soonish.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you exactly when, but I bet it comes out in July.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one theory that they want to do all these releases together. So like iOS 12.4 and watchOS, what is it, like 5.3 point something, maybe? I don't know, but they're weird numbers. But there's this story that we didn't get to talk about last week because we recorded before it, but where walkie-talkie is turned off, the service between Apple Watches where you can send an instant that message and like hear it in real time, because of a security flaw that would let your iPhone be prone to like eavesdropping, similar to the FaceTime group chat stuff. But in this case, the handling of it is way better, and so it's gotten way less attention.
What's funny about the walkie-talkie bug is that, you know, behind the scenes, the walkie-talkie system is basically making like a FaceTime audio call.
Yes.
And just puts a different UI over the top of it. But when group FaceTime bug, when that fiasco came up, Apple made a statement at the time that not only are we fixing the bug, we've also conducted a full security audit of the FaceTime protocol, and we've gone through, you know, with a fine tooth comb or whatever. And now it's July, and although it's not a FaceTime feature, walkie-talkie does actually work on the FaceTime protocol under the hood. And
yeah,
they seem to have a pretty bad issue going on here.
Yeah. So just this week, my brother-in-law got an Apple Watch for the first time, and my sister has an Apple Watch, so they're married, and they're like, oh, what's this icon in the control center? And, you know, what's this icon down here? And I was like, oh, that's for walkie-talkie, but the service doesn't work right now because of this. And they're like, oh, so it does nothing yet. And I was like, yeah, it used to for a while, and now it doesn't anymore, but hopefully soon. But I think that the theory is that maybe the watchOS update will repair walkie-talkie, because it's been out for maybe like a week now, and that it'll be all like one update for everything, and that will include Apple Card. So maybe next week, if that's what's holding it back. But surely in July, like when they say summer, it can mean up to like some part of September. But surely they want to have this out before like the September event and all the new products.
Yeah, clearly this is not an iOS 13 release, or at least it wasn't intended to be back in March.
Right. Yeah.
They said Apple Arcade was full and Apple TV Plus was full and Apple Card is summer. Yep. So clearly it's not iOS 13 connected. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. Some stuff new in iOS 13 beta 4. 3D touch has kind of been tuned up, not like repaired as we wanted to be, but what's going on there?
Yeah, so they've brought back more than nothing of the 3D touch interactivity, especially on like the home screen. Now you are able to 3D touch down, quickly bring up the quick actions, slide to select one and let go, all in one gesture. And they brought back, like, on the thing that was killing me was on, you know, lock screen notifications. If you want to see the previews, up to now on iOS 13 beta, mm-hmm. you had to like press down and then let go for it to actually pop open the thing. Now you can just press and it opens it up. It's still clearly designed in a way that ensures a future iPhone can come out without 3D touch, as we expect with the iPhone 11, and not be excluded from functionality, because all of these behaviors also work with long press as well. For instance, the pop part of a peek and pop gesture is still missing an action and is never coming back because of what I just said. Mm-hmm. But for instance, you can, if you don't use the 3D touch or haptic touch, you can long press on the app icon. It will take longer to show, but as soon as it does, you can then slide and select. It is slightly a bit wonky at the moment in this beta, because if you slide and select, but then slide too far, it turns that interaction into a drag, which is intended behavior. They want you to be able to go seamlessly from a context menu to a drag, but it just seems like the boundary or the distance of free region is too short at the moment, because it's quite easy to start a drag when you just want to select an item.
Yeah, and I've also found that it's really easy to try and rearrange your icons on accident, and they've added this new option in that pop-up menu when you 3D touch, whatever we're going to call it now, I guess it's all changing. When you get the menu, you know, on the home screen icons, you can now you can tap an item there and go into rearrange mode, like jiggly mode. I would like it if they took away like long press to rearrange and just made it that part of that menu. Cause I'm still not as happy as, like, you know, 3D touch since the 6S, when you can long, like, press into an icon, a menu pops out of it, and with just like a smooth gesture, you swipe up and let off on the item that you want to launch, like new tab in Safari, for example. And the way it's also different, if you've got a widget there, I think it's just not finished yet. It's a beta, so that makes sense, and they're getting better. But I hope that something tolerable ships, or else I just forget about that feature altogether, because it's hard to use now.
Yeah, one thing that kind of sucks is that the new menu design, just the rows of each button are really small compared to like the 3D touch menu of the home screen quick actions that we knew before. Mm-hmm. It's like three times the old quick actions rows were like three times the height of what you have now. Like, you have really, really skinny little icons with small icons and small text, and obviously your finger's not very big, so it's quite easy to hit the wrong thing. So that's just one thing where I think it can make it, you know, because also just making each button bigger would also mean you've got more space to do the slidey gesture, which would then mean you're less likely to start dragging the icons around. So there's a lot of like complementary benefits there, mm-hmm. compared to what they had before. So, you know, it's definitely better than what it was in beta 1. Obviously, we talked about this, you know, before. They're definitely not going to bring back peek and pop and stuff like that, because it's not going to work with the future hardware, which is not going to include 3D touch, we assume, and is supported by rumors. But they've definitely at least added some more speed to the gesture, rather than everyone being constrained to the long press speed.
Yeah, and the big curiosity here, you know, it does seem all but confirmed that every new iPhone coming out this fall, for whatever reason, won't have 3D touch in the way that we know it now. Won't have the physical hardware that would enable the old features. It's not that this is better, it's that this is what they're able to do now, for some reason. And there's this April 4th, 2018 Mark Gurman Bloomberg story about Apple considering future iPhone models with hover gestures and curved screens. We've not heard more about that yet, but it seems like maybe that's where you get to, and that, like, this is like part of that transition. So I wonder if, you know, in September we see this stuff surface, or if it's just a transition state toward that, whatever that even is, because that was pretty like scientific, you know, like sci-fi kind of stuff. Like, your finger's over the screen, but you don't press into it. You like hold over an icon and it senses that. So It doesn't seem like we're getting there this year, but we're
that,
certainly...
That will sound like a feature for like the 2020 redesign kind of thing. So I think the iPhone 11 is just going to be like the iPhone XR in terms of like haptic touch everywhere.
And then in the a very minor thing, but in the trends feature, so when you're using the Apple Watch and you have the activity app on your iPhone, you get trend data for different metrics over the last 90 days and compared to a year. So it's a whole trends thing. They've got a new metric called, it's like stand minutes, not just your stand hours where you move around for at least 1 minute of at least 12 hours in a day to hit a goal there and how that is relative to other times. But now how many minutes within an hour you move around, I suppose. And it's only tracking since you installed the watchOS 6 beta. So the trend appeared in iOS 13 beta 4, but it's been tracking this data not since forever, but since at least watchOS 6 beta 1. So they're expanding trends and adding more to that section.
Yeah. So now rather than a number like, you stood up in 8 of the 12 hours of today, it will say, like, on average, you were standing up for 5 minutes of the hour.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's informative.
Yeah, it's an interesting, like, different axis on the same information.
All right, that's it for the 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour podcast. If you enjoy the show, you can subscribe in Apple Podcast or Overcast if you haven't already to receive new episodes every week. You could also rate us or review us in either one, and that helps more people discover the show, which is awesome for us and listeners too. Or share the podcast with a friend. We really appreciate that. And one last thing I want to say, episode 2 of my new Watch Time podcast is out this week. And in that, I interview my good friend and sort of personal fitness coach, Jacob Knight. And we talk about his weight loss journey with the Apple Watch and kind of muscle building, which is not something that I'm super good at, but he is. And also our history of running together, including half marathons, and then an unlikely marathon that he ran on his own. So check that out. And then episode 3 will be out in 2 weeks. And I've already recorded that. I think the episodes keep getting better and better. It's a big one. So do subscribe to that as well. That's 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time. And we'll do something new this week. So if you want to submit any questions to Benjamin Mayo and I, just tweet either of us or use the hashtag ask9to5mac. So that's ASK9TO5MAC. And we'll see if we can answer any questions in some future episodes. I know a lot of podcasts like to do that, and listeners have been asking for that for a while. So use ask9to5mac on Twitter, hashtag ask9to5mac, and we'll see what we get. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And also follow 9to5Mac on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at 9to5Mac. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.